It was a report where a man had been sold into the human slave traffic in the Middle East. A very terrible, terrible event. And with this Middle Eastern country is a dictatorship. And apparently, he was sold into the slave traffic by his own immediate family. He then was put into domestic servitude for life in one of the government members' households. He then was unfortunately and wrongfully accused of rape, and he was sent to a government-sponsored prison where he languished. He was released, but only after many years. And one would think this would be quite devastating to anyone. After so many severe setbacks, it's remarkable that he would even be released. Let me read you a part of that story as it was read to me. It says in this report, it says, Yosef, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the small boy was the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. And by now you know I'm reading the story of Joseph. Turn with me, if you would, to chapter 37 of the book of Genesis. That's where we'll turn, and that's where we'll spend the majority of our time today. Let's read it now in the vernacular as we know it. Verse 1. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the story of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, or Yasaf as it is in the Hebrew, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. It says, now Israel, in verse 3, loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Now right there we'll stop, and we need to give you a little bit of background. The story of little Joseph and his journey through a number of seemingly highly destructive events is one of the longest, if not the longest, and I think by my count it is by far the longest story in the Bible centered around one individual. Some 14 chapters are devoted to Joseph and this journey. And it's in a remarkable way which I think we can relate in many ways. I promise, I make you this promise now, I will not read all 14 chapters, but we will cover them. So today, allow me to discuss with you what I think is an unmatched story in biblical history for a single human being who went from the bowels, literally, of a pit meant for death to the seat next to the Pharaoh of Egypt. And indeed, when we are at our lowest, possibly we need an example so that we can all turn back and say, ask Joseph what this means. So in Genesis 37, we set the stage for the story. These stories are so important that we will read that without Joseph and the events, there is no Moses as we know it. There is no Exodus. There's no entrance into Canaan. There's no conquering of the land. There's no concept of a kingdom of Israel, no establishment of Jerusalem. Therefore, there is no place setting for the Messiah. None of that happens, not the way we read it. It would have had to have been a completely different way. And if you were to pick a series of events for the rise of the Messiah, the chapters that we'll read is hardly the way that I would have decided to do it. And so, but God did. So these sections, so these chapters, are absolutely critically pivotal to what we know and understand in the New Testament. This was a family, unfortunately, where strife existed. Jacob, as a father, was hardly a father. And if you've read the story, he would not have been picked for the show that I grew up watching, Father Knows Best. He was not. He had a problem with the truth. He had a problem with deceit. And yet even then, God had him planned for great things. He labored, as we know, with his uncle Laban for nearly 20 years. He had two wives, one barren, one fruitful. And this is just Jacob, Joseph's father. And so ensued, because one was barren and one was fruitful, we had what we know in the Bible in Genesis of the handmaid wars, or the concubine wars, of who was going to have more children. And indeed, multiple children were born. Chuck Swindoll, in his commentary on Joseph, as only he can do, says, this all adds up that you've got one husband, two wives, two concubines, four mothers, 11 sons, one daughter, all of which did not equal marital bliss. Instead, there was jealousy, there was strife, there was anger, there was lust, there was deceit, there was competition and secrecy. And those are just the high points. But we get to read about these. And into this enter Joseph, the baby. Babies in the family, the youngest are always the much loved, right? How many of you have more than one child? Better yet, how many of you were had brothers and sisters where you were the oldest? Yeah, welcome to the firstborn guinea pigs, right? My oldest son reminds us often how cruel, i.e. experimental, we were on him. And how when we got to the last child, the baby, the favored one, the anointed one, that he never had to experience what he had to his firstborn. So when Mr. Sharp mentioned the firstborn, we were the experimental ones for our parents, were we not? And so enters Joseph. So let's pick up Joseph's story. Verse 3 again. Now Israel loved Jacob. Now remember Joseph. Now remember, Israel is also a name for Jacob, and they're exchanged back and forth. It was Jacob in verse 2, now it's Israel in verse 3. Now Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children. Now, I have another comment. How many of you as parents told your children, I love you better than the others? Not a bright idea. I can see the ladies, the men. Why are the men nodding and the women are shaking their head? That's not a good sign, guys. Don't tell your children you love them more than another. Bad, bad, bad. And yet, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more, they saw this. They were rejoiceful and happy at the love bestowed on him about... No, it says, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him, and they couldn't even speak peaceably to him. Now, I'm glad we had a message on Thanksgiving where we should give thanks. Unfortunately, there'll be relatives there. And many times, it's very difficult at Thanksgiving. This is also an opportunity for all of us at Thanksgiving to speak peaceably one to another. But in Joseph's family, it says they couldn't do that. It was full of strife, especially with this competition. Verse 5, now Joseph had a dream. Now, if it wasn't bad enough, it's going to get a lot worse. In verse 5, the dreamer begins. And he told this dream to his brothers, and they hated him all the more. So this is just gasoline on this fire. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. Now I want to ask you a question. We know the result, they hated him all the more. Now we're going to hear how Joseph told this dream. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. Hey, what do you think of that? And I think it's important for us when we read this, we can read it as black type on white paper. That's not how it is. It's not how it is. It was a real story. And you can only imagine that brothers then are like brothers now. What did you just say? And so his brothers said to him, we rejoice at this dream. There's probably something good in this. No, that's not what they said. Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for all his dreams. And so you can see this buildup, and we read the text as it was written. They didn't like him to begin with because daddy... Right? Daddy liked you best. Number two, they hated him all the more, right? This technicolor coat was given to him. So just think of this. Have you ever known someone who wore a piece of clothing all the time? All the time. It was very special to them. Many times I know of a couple of people I can think of very easily. They wore certain clothes at certain times because it was given to them by their parents. So it was very, very special to them. It was their identifier. And that's important. I know a young man who wore a hat that his father had given him. He rarely, if ever, I kid you not, this hat was very, very important to him. He rarely took it off. And the reason was he had been given this hat from his father. And so it was very special. So it gets worse. Verse 9, then he dreams still another dream. Joseph doesn't seem to learn very quickly. Look, I've dreamed another dream. And they said, oh, please, tell us the dream. The first one was so wonderful, we'd like to hear another. And this time, if you thought the sheaves analogy was bad, now he goes heavenly. He says, this time, the sun, the moon, and even the 11 stars. 11, 11, not 10, not 12. The 11 stars bowed down to me. And it's incredible that Joseph, I'm reading into it, I know, he doesn't seem to understand what this dream is. We can read it. We kind of get a grasp, right? But he apparently didn't. And so, verse 10, he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father, Jacob, rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him. But his father kept the matter. The phrase is very, very similar about the things that Mary heard and about Jesus and kept them in her heart. He remembered them. So we're given the impression here, that Joseph possibly doesn't understand. He was a younger individual. He possibly didn't understand because we see no interpretation except by the brothers and the mother and the father. It's quite interesting. And so all this animosity from this dreamer has occurred. And so we move to a very interesting story. Verse 12. Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. Now what was he doing alone? I don't know, but all the others were out working. So he said to him, here I am, send me. Then he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks and bring back word to me. So he sent him out to the valley of Hebron and went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, what are you seeking? So he said, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they have departed from here. For I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now I don't want to interrupt the story too much, but Shechem and Dothan were very, very important to what had happened prior. Very, very bad things happened in those two areas prior. And I invite you to read 3 or 4 chapters earlier to 37. These place names are critically important to prior story. So this has a lot of what we'd say, a lot of credence of why he's using it. Bad things have happened here before. Verse 18, now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, look, the dreamer is coming. Right? A name rightfully given. Name rightfully given. Come, therefore, let us kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, we'll lie. Some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. Interesting. Now remember, there is a hierarchy. And once again, Mr. Sharp's point about firstborn or first fruits is very interesting. Because verse 21, Reuben heard it. Who's Reuben? Reuben is firstborn. Reuben has the least or the most to lose if Joseph's dreams comes true. He has the most to lose. In those days, there's the theory of what's called primogeniture, right? Which all of us firstborn know, understand, and believe that it is a godly thing. What that means is firstborn always gets the most. That's what it means. It's biblical. All the second and third born are laughing. That's too bad. That's what it means. But Reuben heard it, and he had a little bit of compassion. And he delivered them out of their hands and said, don't kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. He had the most to lose. So Reuben does a noble thing and rescues his brother from his other brothers. Verse 23, apparently we infer that Reuben has left the scene. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic. the tunic of many colors that was on him. Remember, this is his identifier. This is the thing they hated. So the first thing they do is they get rid of this thing, which represents the great love that Jacob had for Joseph. They strip him of his coat. They took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. In other words, he'd starve. He'd starve to death. He had no food and no water. He'd dehydrate. And they sat down to eat a meal. Wouldn't that be great? I mean, you know your family loves you, right? They throw you into a pit. Hey, anybody hungry? Let's go to Jack in the Box. They sit down to eat a meal. The cold, non-compassionate nature of this. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bringing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill him and conceal his blood? No money in that. What do we get out of this? Come, verse 27, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh. At least we can get a quick buck out of this. Let them kill him." And his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit. Poor Joseph thinking, "I'm freed." And then they turned right around and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph, the Ishmaelites did, to Egypt. Interesting point, 20 shekels of silver, there's something called the Mari, M-A-R-I, tablets that were discovered archaeologically. And they indeed say at this time, 20 shekels of silver was the price of a slave. So he sold into slavery by his brothers, and he's taken down. You'll notice the phrase down to Egypt, up to Canaan. And if you look at a map, it's a little on the south, more like southwest. And you'll hear this phrase a lot as we read. Verse 29, then Reuben returned to the pit. Remember, the eldest comes back to the pit. He's been gone somewhere, obviously. And indeed, Joseph was not in the pit. He tore his clothes, right? That's a sign of upset, of, oh, what is wrong? He tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more. And I, where shall I go? What are we going to do?" Notice the response. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, dipped the tunic in the blood. It doesn't say they told Reuben what happened. It says they took the tunic and said, they brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" What a stupid question. This is so cruel. They are lying and deceiving their father, aren't they? A little like Jacob did to his father. It's fascinating. The one thing that identified Joseph to his father was that tunic of many colors. And he sees it covered with blood. "Dad, do you know if this is Joseph's or not?" Of course he knew it was. Verse 33, and he recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." This is Jacob speaking. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted and said, "For I shall go down to the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. It's a sad thing that this great discomfort and this grieving that Jacob went through barely leaves him all his life, if you read these chapters. When he felt that his son was dead, his youngest son, the one that he loved so much. In verse 36, now the Midianites, it's interchangeable with the Ishmaelites, they had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And indeed, this one phrase is so, so important because this shows the mechanism of how the Israelites or Hebrews descended into Egypt. This is how they got there. It was a young man, the tribe of Jacob, is sold into slavery, and as a slave, he enters Egypt. And we know the rest of the story. But this is how it begins. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. So not only is he sold once, Joseph is sold twice. He's sold once by his brothers to the Midianites. The Midianites sell him again to the slave trade in Egypt and becomes a household servant. 38, chapter 38, we will skip because it is an inset, and we pick it up again in chapter 39. Notice the phrasing geographically. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Go down to Egypt. And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard of the Egyptians, they bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Eternal was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Eternal was with him, and that the Eternal made all he did to prosper in his hand. In three chapters, this is the only time God is mentioned. We will see God is not mentioned very often, but we will also see that God is ever present with Joseph, no matter what it happens. But this is the catalyst that speaks to all that remains of the next four chapters in the Bible, the Torah. It is this one event that is the catalyst, the springboard that starts the whole process of events through the rest of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and on into Joshua and Judges. It's this one verse, or these sets of verses here in chapter 39. It says the Lord was with him. And you can see it from Joseph's perspective for just a moment. The Lord was with him. Because it is the first time God is mentioned, it's mentioned in a very interesting way. Did it say it was something Joseph said, that Potiphar knew that God was with him? No, it does not say that. Did Joseph pronounce his faith? Did he speak to Potiphar and his household about what he believed? No, it doesn't say that. Potiphar saw. He could tell. And we need to ask ourselves in these verses, how did he know? How did he know? He knew because of what he saw, because Joseph did not ask for special favors. He did not ask for special conditions. He was a slave, a household slave. It's what he obviously did. And we're not even told the details of what Joseph did. It was his actions, the way he acted, the attitude that he had in the household of Potiphar. God blessed him in some way we are not told. Of no details are we given. But Potiphar, this mighty man in Egypt, the captain of the guard, no less, saw and knew that Joseph was favored by his actions. At this juncture, what do we learn? At this juncture, we learn, and we can ask the question very easily. It is not what we say, or is it more what we do? What we do. Saying is important. Saying the verses and understanding the verses and reading God's word is important. But don't we have the phrase, action truly speaks? Don't we use the phrase, I can't hear what you're saying because your actions are so loud? And they dismiss, they remove, they reverse, they cancel what you said. I'm sorry, I'm not listening to what you're saying because I'm watching what you're doing. Indeed, Joseph was doing right. In fact, it says in the book of James that faith or belief, it's important, it's unbelievably important. And that's what Joseph had. But Joseph had more than that. James says, faith without what? Action, works, it is dead. The faith is brought into practice by the things that we do or the things that we do not do. By the way, when did we stop keeping Christmas? I'm kidding. It was interesting. I happened to notice, I'm sure you all did, there are things that we observe. Thanksgiving is not a holy day. But you see how important it is to us. If anything was to be made a holy day, right? That comes pretty close. Thanksgiving to us is not a holy day, but it's pretty close because it is so rich with meaning to us. We make a distinction. How different I was struck by Thanksgiving and Christmas. Thanksgiving and getting. The day of Thanksgiving and the day of I hope I get. I hope I get. And even by, it's not bad. When you make a holiday out of it, it's brought into great prominence. And so we pick up the story. I promised I wasn't going to read the whole thing to you. And Potiphar, in his household, Joseph has achieved a great place. In verse 7, we pick up the story. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, look, hey, my master does not know what is with me in the house. My master does not know what is with me in the house, or who better, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness? Further, he says, and sin against God. These are the few words that we hear that Joseph ever says to Potiphar's, in Potiphar's household, and he says it to his wife. So it was, verse 10, that she spoke to Joseph day by day. She persisted, and that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. He didn't want to be with her. That's how much wisdom Joseph had. Don't even be near her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men were in the house inside, that she caught him by his garment. Notice how clothing is an ever-present theme with poor Joseph. It's his clothing, as we'll see once again, is very important in the story. Lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside that she called to the men of the house and spoke to them. Potiphar, has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came into me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. Lie upon lie upon lie. We drop down to verse 19. And so it was when Potiphar's master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, Your servant, they must have had a really good marriage. Can you tell? Right? It's another great biblical marriage, right? And so it was when his master heard the words of his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, blah, 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 that his anger was aroused. No kidding. Then Joseph's master, Potiphar, took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. Now let's see. Back up. Stop. We go from brothers to pit, to Midianites, to slavery, right? To Potiphar's house and elevation, now into prison. This isn't what we would call an upward momentum. It's not getting good. They did not put them in prison for a period for statutory rape of 7 to 10 years. It was for life. It was forever. And so, but it also then says, he was there in the prison, verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. Sound familiar? It is an exact replication of what happened to the almost the letter of what happened in Potiphar's house. Now, I want you to think of this from Joseph's perspective. I went from a pit to slave trade to slavery in Potiphar's house. He elevates me. I get in trouble. I get thrown in prison. I'm elevated. I'm going to be in trouble again. What went Joseph's mind? We're not told. It's fascinating. But it says God was with him and God elevated him again. It's strange. Favored by his father. Put in a pit by his brothers. As a slave, he's favored by his master. In prison from his wife's lives. Put in prison. Favored by the jailer. But he was going down further and further. Compare the two. What would you rather be in Potiphar's house as the master of the household? Or would you rather be the head of the prison? Somehow I don't think there's an equal sign there. It's like this. It's not going in the right direction. Yes, he gets elevated, but he's going down further and further. But two guests arrive in the prison. It came to pass, chapter 40, after these things, that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the baker. Sounds like the start of a joke, doesn't it? Right? And so Pharaoh was angry with them. He put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison of the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them and served them. And they were in custody for a while. And then, lo and behold, verse 8. we see another repetition. Here is the dreamer in prison, but does not give interpretations. Now look what happens. They, the butler and the baker, said to him, Joseph, we each have had a dream, and there is no interpreter of it. Joseph doesn't seem to be an interpreter. He seems to be a dreamer. And yet, look what happens. Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, behold, in a dream, a vine was before me. And then Joseph proceeds to tell him the interpretation. It is interesting at best. Interesting at best that now Joseph is interpreting dreams. What is his motivation? Let me ask you a question. If you were Joseph and two people came to you for help in the prison, would you bother helping them? Most people would not. What's the point? What's the point? Joseph interprets the baker's dream. Unfortunately, the interpretation is he will be executed. Not a happy thought. The butler also has a dream, and he is restored, but he forgets Joseph. He forgets him, and he's left in prison. So we have to say to ourselves, the dream interpreted by God, he does so for seeming no reason. At this juncture, we ask another question. Joseph can say to himself, I've interpreted their dreams. I tried to do what was good. I said, please remember me when you come back into the presence of Pharaoh. Please remember me. They did not. He did not. Did he say, we don't know, I will rot in this jail. I am the favored one, and yet I'm in prison. So what? This is where God has brought me. This would be normal. This would be expected. We are not told what he said, but it is quite logical. It's quite logical, it's quite expected, it's quite natural, because that is the way many of us feel when this happens to us. Keep in mind, and this is my interpretation, not to read into any of it, these men are not saints. They are not perfect. They do not have perfect thoughts. If you went from a pit to slavery to prison and had been forgotten, your faith would be challenged. Everyone's would. But then something else happens. Turn with me, if you would, to chapter 41. And then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he stood by the river. Suddenly there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them, out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and the gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine looking fat cows. So Pharaoh awoke. Yeah, I'd wake up. He slept and dreamed a second time, and suddenly 7 heads of grain came up in 1 stalk, plump and good. Then behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them, and the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, yeah, and indeed it was a dream. Verse 8, now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told him his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret the dream for Pharaoh. Pharaoh was probably not happy. If you'd have brought all your magicians, all the best that you have, your wise men that you'd trusted for years, and this is do or die time. I've had these 2 dreams. It scares me to death. What do they mean? And his magicians say, I don't know. Now, he's just put the butler and the baker to prison, elevated one, and chopped the head off of the other one. I imagine the magicians and the wise men felt they were not in a real good place at this point. The Pharaoh is, remember this, the Pharaoh is a god in Egypt. Verse 9, then the chief butler spoke up to Pharaoh, saying, I remember my faults this day. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants, moi, and put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker, oh, the one you cut his head off, we each had a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. There was this young Hebrew man with us, a servant of the captain of the guard, and we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man he interpreted according to his own dream. What that means in the original means he gave us the details of what we dreamt. And it came to pass just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office, and he hanged the other guy. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the... Quickly. Just picture this in your mind's eye as a real event. The Pharaoh finds a guy. He's in the prison. Right? And the butler's just told him, I know somebody. I'm sorry, I've forgotten. This guy interprets dreams. Where is he? He's in your prison. He's in your prison. What would you do if you were Pharaoh? You would grab your biggest and best and fastest guards, get down to the prison, and drag this guy to me right now. Why? I want an answer to these dreams. He was troubled. This is a crisis. And so he sent and called for Joseph. They brought him quickly out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothes, and came to Pharaoh. They had to make him presentable. He looked like a bum in a pit in a prison. They fix him up, clean him up, right? You're a mess. We can't present you to Pharaoh. He's a god. We have to clean you up. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I can imagine, I know I'm reading in, I imagine he looked across at the wise men and the magicians, and no one can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it. Listen to Joseph's response, the first thing out of his mouth. Yes, I am an interpreter of dreams. That's what I do. It's me. He said, no. And I don't mean to be flippant. I mean to explain, listen to what he says. It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. In other words, I will tell you what it means. You are troubled by these two dreams you've had. I will interpret it, and God will give you peace. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream, I stood on the bank of the river. Why, he says the bank of the river. What river was he talking about? The Nile. There was nothing more important to Egypt, nothing more important than the Nile. It, too, was considered a very holy river and a part of the religion of Egypt. Verse 25, we skip, and Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do, what God is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Bada bing, bada boom. He's done. Pharaoh is shocked. Keep in mind, it is before the Nile he stands. We are not told, but anyone who knows Egyptian history knows that the crops are dependent upon one event and one event only, the flooding of the Nile. When the Nile does not flood and lifts up the water and all the silt fertilizes the land, the crops grow. The rain is very, like right now, what we have, they have very little rain. They depend on the Nile and the rains that go into the Nile. This is powerfully important. And now Joseph is seen to do what no magician or wise man can do. He basically is telling Pharaoh, as we know well, he says, you need to prepare. You need to plan. And so we read in verse 37, so the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh. This is chapter 41, verse 37. So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh, in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? If anyone tells you that Old Testament patriarchs did not have God's Spirit, point them to this verse. It's very simple. Joseph had God's Spirit. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and as wise as you are. You shall be over my house. All my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. By the way, I'm Pharaoh, you're not. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. It's happened again. But it's happened, as we know, for the final time for Joseph. He is second in command. To the extent, verse 42, Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before him, bow the knee. Notice the phrase. That is a critical part in the interpretation of the prophecy of the dreams that Joseph had. Bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him a wife, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Was Joseph still a believer? Absolutely. Was he considered an Egyptian? Absolutely. Did he follow God? Absolutely. We are not told any details about the daily or weekly or monthly or yearly life, except all that he did was second only to Pharaoh. So he indeed is an interpreter of dreams. What are we to think? What can we learn from this? What, in fact, in all of this, where God is mentioned so little, but is present so much, does it say to us possibly that we are in the same place from time to time? That many times when we're in the pit, we're in the prison, we seem to be in slavery, we seem to be bound by things we cannot control, we cannot see or even imagine anything ever happening that's better. You know, and I know, everyone in this room, at any age, in any spot in their life, we know that God has a plan. The bad news is, about believing in God, there is a bad news. He doesn't always tell us what's going to happen. We wish that he did. I've asked, I know you've asked, but somehow God doesn't seem to want to tell us the details of the future. We have to experience them. Brethren, if he didn't tell Joseph, he's not going to tell us. And there's a reason. He wants us to know and understand because Joseph knew and understand that God was with him. God was always with him. Joseph, as we do, knew something else. Joseph knew his past. Joseph knew what had happened to him, both the good and the bad. And he knew and he remembered that God had restored him over and over and over again. Did he despair unto great despair? I doubt it. But I imagine he did have doubts. That would be human and that would be logical. But at the end of the day, he could remember, and we should remember. The remaining chapters of this book, the famine does hit. It is widespread. It is devastating. You can read those chapters. It is a wonderful, wonderful story. Jacob, back in Canaan, sends his 11 remaining sons to Egypt to buy bread, to buy grain, whatever. He had heard news. They had bread and they had grain in Egypt. So he sends his sons, most of his sons, not all 11, he sends most of his sons to Egypt. They encounter Joseph, as we know, but they do not recognize Joseph. Again, read the story, the details. They don't recognize him because he doesn't look like them. He was now an Egyptian vizier. He didn't have shepherd clothing on and a yarmulke. He looked like an Egyptian. What he was wearing, we can only imagine. But through a series of events where Joseph, in fact, Joseph, the vizier to Pharaoh, he has a bit of fun, which we could interpret as revenge, on his brothers. He convinces them to bring Benjamin, the youngest. Later, he then convinces them to bring Joseph. But in chapter 45, it all comes together. Turn with me there, if you would. I want you to picture this again. This is some great hall. Joseph's brothers are there. Joseph is in this hall as well, I would imagine, as we see in so many Egyptian archaeological reliefs, that Joseph is probably on a pedestal. He may be in a chair. He may have a staff in his hand. He's still faithful to God, but he's in the Egyptian government. He's in the Egyptian government. And so he looks like an Egyptian official. And so they don't recognize him at all. So he's in his full regalia. He's probably surrounded by attendants. He's second in command to the Pharaoh. He's in his second chariot. He's got attendants that would fill this room more than likely. They went with him everywhere. And there are his brothers. And his brothers, because they are not Egyptians especially, how would they be acting toward Pharaoh, to Joseph? They would be on their knees. Bow the knee as they entered the room. Now, in this scene, and again I ask you to read it at your leisure, in this scene, who remembered the dream? Joseph. His brothers didn't know they were kneeling before Joseph. And so they're begging him for no more demands. Does Joseph realize the prophecy has come to pass? I would think he did. And this is some of the most moving and poignant scenes, I believe, in all the Bible that are about to come to play. So in chapter 45, verse 1, we pick up the story. Again, this is Joseph with his brothers. And we've jumped a number of chapters in this back and forth. And he's watched his brothers over and over and over again, coming and going. Weeks and months have passed because traveling from Egypt to Canaan requires a tremendous amount of time. And so Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, talking about his attendants. And he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." Right? He orders his attendants to leave. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. They're outside. He's told them to leave. Shut the door. Right? They can hear the emotion on the other side of the door. Joseph then says to his brothers, "I am Joseph." And he asks, "Does my father, Jacob, still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. The word dismayed in the original Hebrew means terrified. They are terrified. This guy has just revealed himself, who they think is next to Pharaoh. This is Joseph. Joseph. Joseph, Joseph is dead. Joseph is dead. He's a slave somewhere, maybe, but we don't know. They couldn't believe it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near me." That's about the last thing they wanted to do. So they did come near him, and he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, by the way, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it is not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Hurry, go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near to me. You and your children, your children's children, your flocks, your herds, your frogs, your snakes, your children's children, all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. Behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt, and of all that you have seen, and all you shall hurry and bring my father down.'" Verse 14, "Then he fell on his brother Benjamin." Remember, Benjamin's the youngest. Is the next youngest. The brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. I'll bet they talked with him. Now the report of it was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brothers have come. So it pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your animals and depart. Go to the land of Canaan, bring your father and your household and come to me. I will give you the best land of Egypt, and you will eat of the fat of the land. Now you are commanded, do this. Take carts out of the land of Egypt for your little ones, your wives, bring your father. Everybody comes to Egypt and to avert the famine. Verse 21, then the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them carts according to the command of Pharaoh, and he gave them provisions for the journey, but gave to them each man changes of garments. But to Benjamin, a special blessing, he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. And he sent to his father these things: 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and food for his father for a journey. And so he sent his brothers away, and they departed. And he said to them, see that you do not become troubled along the way. I imagine they were in double, triple shock. They could not believe what had just happened. In chapter 50, toward the end of the book of Genesis, is a very interesting phrase. Chapter 50 and verse 20. If I can find it. Verse 19, start there. Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for I am in the place of God. In other words, no, I'm not. But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Things sometimes are meant for evil. There are people that we will encounter. They're bad. They're bad people. And they mean it for evil. And evil has happened to God's people. But sometimes God uses this evil, as he did in Joseph's life, for good. Because we cannot pass from this life without these things happening. Joseph had it happen to him. Who are we to be spared from it all? But it also tells us things. I know that Passover is 4 months away. This is the longest stretch of non-holy day from the eighth day to the beginning of the sacred year in Passover in the days of unleavened bread. We have 4 months. I would ask you, it'll take you 45 minutes to an hour. That's all I ask, is that you read all of Genesis chapter 37 to 50. Because it prepares us and it sets the stage completely and utterly, historically and theologically, for what happens in the spring with Passover and the Exodus. It tells the backstory, as it were. But what does the life of Joseph tell us? Why is it here? Is it just good history? Is it just good theater? No, I believe it's there for a reason. That although we may never be Pharaoh's right-hand man or woman, God is still the unseen partner. Always there, always with Joseph, always with us. We are to be very thankful and grateful. There is a reason we are all in this room. It's not because of our goodness, it's not because of our intelligence, but it's because of what God has given us, the truth he has given us, and the salvation through his Son, Jesus Christ. But often, from the pit that we feel we may be in, often that pit we help dig. Our handprints are on the shovel of that pit, even though that may be the case. Or it was a pit we did not choose and had nothing to do with. Though we may seem to be in slavery, in a job or a situation, a health issue, a financial issue, we feel we're in prison. Joseph's story tells us that God is with us. And maybe sometimes, just like Joseph, we need to look back. We need to look back, in other words, to look forward. It's only in the rearview mirror that we see where we have been. You'll notice in your car, when you drive it, you have one windshield. And most cars have at least two, by law, at least two. But most have 3 rearview mirrors. It's so we can always see where we have been. And I think in a lot of ways, Genesis chapter 37 to 50 is a little bit of a reminder to look in the rearview mirror, to see from where we have come. We may need to look back in order to look forward. And that is where the gratefulness and the thanksgiving occur. We remember that God over and over again delivers us and takes care of us. So in many ways, maybe we are all like Joseph's. Maybe God indeed, in fact he does, have something or has given you something already that is very wonderful. Maybe something later even more wonderful as he did with Joseph. So when we are in the pit, sometimes when we are in despair, I'll ask you to always, always pray to God. That goes without saying. But also you might want to ask Joseph.